Welcome to RHRealityTech.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be talking to Martha Bailey about her research showing how family planning access benefits families and children. The Supreme Court hears arguments about same-sex marriage, and Rush Limbaugh wildly misinterprets a Beyoncé song, not that he'll admit it. If you're as tired about the ridiculous debate over whether women are funny as I am, you'll appreciate this clip from the Showtime documentary, Why We Laugh, Funny Women.
One of the reasons I think women aren't funny is because we're so busy thinking about when we can give our next blowjob. It's like our brains are so crowded up with that. We don't really have time to think of funny things to say.
There's a direct correlation between how unfunny a man is and how little he thinks of women's ability to be funny, I've found. I don't cover gay rights much on this podcast, even though it's part of the greater constellation of sexual liberty issues, because there are so many other great podcasts that cover the issue in depth. That said, the Supreme Court listened to arguments last week regarding the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Prop 8, and I'd be remiss if I didn't cover what could end up being the equivalent of Roe v. Wade for gay rights, or at least covering the conservative reaction, which is getting downright comical as they slowly realize the tide of public opinion has turned against them and they're never getting it back. The standard arguments against legalizing same-sex marriage have collapsed under the weight of their own bad logic. And so instead of bothering to make the same disproved claims, some conservative pundits just pretend to be concerned that gay rights were moving too fast. David Brooks trotted out that line while making like he was trying to be helpful.
To me, the only fear now is the court. The court overreaches and tries to impose a solution from the top, and that sort of freezes and polarizes the debate.
Peggy Noonan didn't try as hard to mimic concern.
Americans don't take it well and don't accept it as a resolution when their black-robed masters in Washington decide to put on them what they decide is the right thing. One of the great sins of Roe versus Wade, the abortion decision of 40 years ago, was that it decided everybody has to do it one way instead of leaving it to the states.
You hear that a lot, that the abortion debate isn't about a bunch of misogynists trying to control women so much as a bunch of misogynists getting mad that a court tried to tell them that they don't get to control women. The idea is by saying, hey, okay, women are in fact your property and you totally have the right to force them to give birth. The misogynists will, in their gratitude, graciously not force their female property to give birth. I'm skeptical and prefer the more straightforward approach to recognizing and protecting all human rights. Either way, we understand that Noonan and Brooks were issuing threats. Either lay off demanding gay rights or we'll never give them to you. I don't think that the gay rights movement should give in to these kinds of threats. At least these two admit that the tide has turned against homophobia, but Gary Bauer just is living in denial. He claimed the public opposes gay marriage, and then this happened.
58% now think same-sex marriage is legal, 36% illegal. 10 years ago, the numbers were the reverse, 37% legal, 55% legal, and there's a big generational shift. Look at this. Among people between the ages of 18 and 39, the margin is 70% to 27. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, big, deep moral and constitutional issues should be decided by polls, but you're also a Republican in addition to being a social conservative. Do you worry that this only puts the Republican Party further out of touch with the mainstream of American voters?
No, I'm not worried about it because the polls are skewed, Chris.
He then went on to try to argue that the anti-gay side losing in 4 states in November was somehow secretly a win. He's just lost the plot, not that he ever really had it. Senator Saxby Chambliss has reacted to the whole thing by not even acknowledging the changing landscape, but just sticking to old-school homophobia.
Support for gay marriage is rising among Americans, except on Capitol Hill, when Senator Saxby Chambliss was asked if his views had changed on gay marriage. The Georgia Republican replied, "I'm not gay, so I'm not going to marry one."
I do like the notion that all laws should be determined strictly by what you personally would do. I will never marry Saxby Chambliss, so I guess marriage to him should also be banned by that measure. I'd like to welcome Martha Bailey to the program. Martha is an assistant professor in the Department of Economics and a research affiliate at the Population Study Center at the University of Michigan, and a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. She recently published a paper with the Brookings Institute called "Family Planning Over the Past Half Century Has Had a Positive Social and Economic Impacts." And she's here today to talk about that paper with us. Welcome to RealityCast, Martha.
Thanks.
So, you started the paper by looking at two major policy changes regarding family planning that started in the 1960s and 70s. Can you briefly explain what those two policy changes were and how they affected women's access to contraception?
Sure. The first is the Griswold decision. It took place in 1965. It was a Supreme Court decision, and this decision struck down Connecticut's ban on the use of contraception under its anti-obscenity statute. And after it was decided, after Griswold was decided, about half of the U.S. States in the U.S. repealed their laws treating contraception as obscene and banning either the sales of contraceptives or the distribution of information about contraceptives. So Griswold is the first policy change, and it significantly increased legal access to contraception for women in about half of the U.S. states. And the second policy change is the introduction of U.S. family planning programs. These began in 1964. They were first funded under the Office of Economic Opportunity, and they provided grants to local organizations to increase or create increase their family planning services or to create family planning programs. And these are the grants that then were continued under Title X of the Public Health Service Act, which funds family planning programs today. So, again, these grants were big policy changes that significantly expanded access to local family planning programs for women, especially poor women in the 1960s.
And that would have mostly been like Planned Parenthood, right?
Well, a lot of the recipients of these grants were Planned Parenthood, but there were lots of other types of providers as well, sort of local nonprofits, clinics,
so,
hospitals.
So you focused on the impact that these policies had specifically on the well-being of children. How did increased access to contraception impact children?
Well, I look at both policy changes, and both are a little bit different. After the Griswold decision, I find that mothers' reports that their children were unwanted fell significantly, and I also find that the birth weight of children is higher than it was for children born right before the Griswold decision, suggesting that this increase in access to contraception may have increased parents' investments in children before they're born, so prenatal investments. But there seems to be no effect of the Griswold decision on the economic resources available to children. Specifically, what I mean are sort of the resources available to children through their parents. Now, in contrast, family planning programs significantly increased family incomes for children. And my comparison here is I'm looking at children born right after family planning programs began operating relative to children born right before they started operating in the same places. So the children who were born just after these family planning programs began were about 5% less likely to live in poverty. They were much less likely to live with single parents and significantly less likely to live in households where their parents received public assistance.
So just as a point of clarification, you looked just at sort of the narrow pre and post these clinics starting.
That's right.
And that's to sort of eliminate other social changes from being an issue, right?
Right. So there's a lot going on in the 1960s, and the objective of a paper like this is to try and separate the effects of, say, family planning or greater changes in laws that increased access to contraception from a lot of the other social changes that were happening in the 1960s and also policy changes. There's just a lot going on. So what I'm using is the fact that these grants roll out sort of on a county-by-county basis, and so they happen at different times all across the country. And so in each one of those places, you can compare the kids born just before versus just after and look for systematic patterns in the way those outcomes change.
So that goes a long way to explaining what was one of the most interesting findings, was that you found that single parenthood was affected. You, and specifically it said there was a 4% reduction in single parenthood in some groups. Can you kind of talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, it is really striking. I think a lot of the concerns about family planning programs or greater access to family planning is that they may increase single parenthood by increasing the likelihood that people are having sex outside of marriage, or maybe they're less concerned about sort of the effects of having sex outside of marriage. So single parenthood has gone up a lot over the last 50 years, and my findings suggest that, in fact, family planning was the force, greater access to contraceptives through family planning programs, greater legal access after the Griswold decision, suggests that these programs actually mitigated some of that increase. So the idea is that the increase in single parenthood might have been even greater in the absence of these programs.
So that's interesting, because one of the arguments that conservatives such as Marjorie Dannenfelser of the SBA list have made is that greater access to contraception, like you said, raises negative outcomes, and specifically raises the level of single parenthood. And she basically has argued just what you said, that it lulls people into thinking it's okay to have sex and they get pregnant by accident and all that implies. So how does that claim really stand up?
Well, I think those concerns are exactly what motivates an empirical study. So there are lots of concerns in theory about what these programs do and don't do, and people often fight a lot about that. So one of my motivations in looking at these outcomes in my study was to actually see what the data says about exactly that concern. And the bottom line is that I find no evidence that that's the case in the data in either of the policy changes that I use. So children born just after the Griswold decision made contraception much more widely available. We're no more likely to be conceived before marriage. So the idea is that if you make increase access to contraceptives, you might see an increase in shotgun marriage, for instance, or you might see an increase in single parenthood. In the case of the Griswold decision, I see there's no increase in shotgun marriage. So kids who are born before or after versus just before the Griswold decision are no more likely to be conceived out of wedlock. And the other thing is that kids born right after family planning programs began were not just no more likely to live in single-headed households. In fact, they were slightly less likely to live in single-headed households.
So, in other words, the amount of premarital sex people were having was not caused.
I can't say anything about that. So people might have been having more sex, but there's definitely not an increase in the number of conceptions that are happening before marriage, and there's not an increase in single parenthood down the road.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, because people could have more sex and it wouldn't show up.
And use more contraception. Yeah, so it's hard to say either way, and I don't have good measures of that. But what I can say is that there's no evidence that there's greater premarital conceptions, and that kids are more likely to live in single-headed households. In fact, they're less likely to live in single-headed households after family planning programs begin.
So anybody who thinks... So the argument that we could somehow reduce the incidence of single parenthood by cutting back on federally subsidized contraception programs is not a very good one.
Well, so there's always a concern that when you're generalizing today from the 1960s, that what do we really learn from the 1960s? And that's hard to say. You know, we think times today are different. There's a lot of different things going on. But the evidence from the 1960s say that wasn't the case then. So when Griswold happened, which increased, was a dramatic increase in access to contraception, we don't see any evidence that children were more likely to be conceived out of wedlock, and we don't see any evidence after family planning programs began that kids were more likely to live in single-headed households. In fact, they were less likely to be in single-headed households down the road. So if anything, these programs seem to have increased the resources available to children, especially poor children, in the 1960s and 70s. Now, what that means for today is a little bit harder to say, but this is some of the best evidence we have on these programs.
So one last question. You also kind of looked at not just children's well-being, but also the chance that children would live in poverty. Can you talk briefly about that?
Well, that's one of the things we're most interested in seeing is sort of it. We weren't just interested in looking to see whether or not the average incomes of children that were born after family planning programs increased, but we wanted to see if incomes were increasing for some of the kids who are most vulnerable. And specifically, we don't think that family planning programs benefit all women equally. We know a lot of higher income women can take can pay for services anyway. So we think family planning programs and these discounted services tend to serve more disadvantaged populations. So we were specifically interested to see whether or not the kids that are born actually end up having slightly more resources. That is, they're more likely or less likely to live in poverty than the kids that are born just before. I mean, there are a couple of reasons you might expect that to be the case. One is that, you know, mothers, by delaying parenthood just a few years, can finish college, can get different types of jobs, can make different types of investments in their careers, can find more stable partnerships. For all of those reasons, you might expect kids' incomes, or the incomes available to kids once they are born, to be slightly higher. And that's exactly what we find, is that there's a big reduction in the incidence of child poverty. Our study finds that it fell about 5% in 5 years for children born in the 5 years after family planning programs began.
Wow, that's pretty significant in just a short period of time, it seems to me.
That's right. It's big. It should be big news for anyone interested in the effects of these policies.
So my guest today has been Martha Bailey. You can read her paper. It's called Family Planning Over the Past Half Century Has Had Positive Social and Economic Impacts. It's available for free at the Brookings Institute website. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Martha.
Thank you.
Rush Limbaugh has once again shot himself in the foot with his obsessive, over-the-top misogyny and his obsession with attacking feminists. The latest idiocy started with a bizarre rant about Beyoncé's new song, Bow Down. The song is basically a kiss-off to her haters, which is a fairly typical genre of song in hip-hop, but for some reason, Limbaugh read it as an ode to female submission.
Beyoncé used to be the lead for a three-girl group called Destiny's Child. And their songs were attempts to inspire young women not to take any grief from men. Is that right, Mr. Snerdly? Essentially, don't take any grief. Don't let these guys walk all over you. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't just walk away. You don't need to put up with that. She's done a 180. Beyoncé, now having been married, having been impregnated and given birth to Blue Ivy, she going out on a new tour, and they may as well call it the Bow Down B.I.H. tour. She's got a new song. Can I say it? It's in the popular Bow Down, bitches.
This is a line I heard a lot when I was younger, as conservative men would claim that it's all cute that I think women are equal, but I'd grow up and want a man and would give up this silly feminism stuff. Now that I'm in my 30s, they've given that up. But this belief persists that women's desperation for male approval will out and will be forced, I tell you, to accept our roles as a servant class to men. So much so that Limbaugh insists that Beyoncé's new song must be about how women should submit to men. The problem is that this is what the lyrics actually say.
I took some time to live my life, but don't think I'm just his little wife. Don't get it twisted, get it twisted. Just my shit. Bow down, bitches.
Despite being completely wrong, Limbaugh gloated about Beyoncé's supposed comeuppance and how she's learned to submit, blah, blah.
Back in the 50s, Beyoncé would have not had to say bow down. Women just did it.
She says she's not just someone's little wife, and don't be confused about that. So, quite literally, the opposite of Limbaugh's wishful thinking. But he's never admitted he's wrong in his life, so watching him try to rationalize being so obviously wrong in the most clear-cut way possible has been quite entertaining. First of all, he claimed to be a victim of evil liberals and their evil strategy of pointing it out when you said something objectively wrong.
We conservatives cannot get away with one-tenth what the left can get away with. Now, yesterday on this program, as part of our outreach to low-information voters, I decided to share with you details of the latest Beyoncé tune and album and tour. I made up nothing. I didn't create a phrase. I didn't create the title of a song. I just read what was in this UK story. So in essence, what I did, I held up a mirror to the left, and they saw themselves, and now they were attacking me.
He's a victim because he basically lied to quote-unquote low-information voters and got caught. How that's holding up a mirror is really hard to understand. Still, the people making fun of how he got the song 100% wrong continued to point this out, and he tried another attempt to do anything but admit that he didn't listen to it before pontificating on how it was supposedly an ode to female submission.
Then the song comes out, and we have a little fun with it based on the feminazi connotations. And these people in the pop culture media are treating this as seriously as anything in their lives. Folks, it's stunning. It is really instructive. Even I, El Rushbowl, continue to learn and to watch how seriously they take this. And it's just a singer.
So now he's claiming that he totally knew it was a feminist song from the get-go. And he's claiming that the attacks are because he opposed the feminism of it. Okay, a refresher of what he actually said.
Beyonce used to be the lead for a three-girl group called Destiny's Child. And their songs were attempts to inspire young women not to take any grief from men. Is that right, Mr. Snurdly? Essentially, don't take any grief. Don't let these guys walk all over you. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't just walk away. You don't need to put up with that. She's done a 180. Beyonce, now having been married, having been impregnated and given birth to Blue Ivy, she going out on a new tour, and they may as well call it the Bow Down B.I.H. tour. She's got a new song. Can I say it? It's in the popular Bow Down, bitches.
So, in sum, Rush Limbaugh was too lazy to listen to Beyonce's new song before he praised it for being an ode to female submission. When he was alerted to the fact that it's actually a celebration of female independence, he pretended not to hear, then claimed to be a victim of the meanie heads who corrected him, and now is pretending that he was attacking it for its feminism all along. Maybe Limbaugh should lay off the relentless attacks on women. It just seems to blow up in his face when he goes there way too often.
When I get down, you know I get down. When I get around, you know I get around.
And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. And now for the weirdest argument you'll hear against gay marriage edition. This is Christian Wright TV host Matthew Hagee.
The same idea of same-sex marriage is the death of capitalism. Consider this. Capitalism requires consumers. Those consumers are produced and they purchase goods from the people who are creating those goods. It is the production of goods and the consumption of goods that sustain the American economy that is driven by capitalism. The only relationship in natural law that can produce consumers is the relationship between a man and a woman. When you create a society that does not recognize this relationship as the foundation of its existence, and you cease to produce what is required to sustain your economy, you will not survive.
Gosh, if only the Soviets had thought of that instead of engaging with a nuclear arms race with the U.S. Seriously, this argument only works if you assume that if women have a chance to marry women, they will not only not marry men, but will abandon the practice of childbirth altogether. How crappy are these right-wing Christian husbands if they think that's actually a legitimate concern?
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.